This is RFR Q&A.
Hey, Star Wars fans, Jimmy Mack here with you, and welcome back to another edition of RFR Q&A. The Q&A coming at you weekly. I look forward to the Q&A every week because I never know what kind of Star Wars conversation I'm going to be getting into. And it's fun to play the field a little bit. You know, me and Swank have that kind of relationship where it's okay to go out and explore and talk to other people about Star Wars every once in a while. Yes, that's right. Very progressive. And joining us this time on the RFR Q&A is a guy who's no stranger to the Q&A. He's been on several times. It's RFR VIP, Jamie Bruno. Jamie.
How you doing, Jimmy Mac?
Oh, I'm doing great, man. I'm doing better now that I'm here talking with you about the wars. Oh, I have some business from last week I want to address here on the Q&A. I don't know how prepared I was to do this because there's a certain little bit of feedback I need to pull up here because I was attempting to quote Samuel L. Jackson, but I was trying to quote him not from Star Wars, but from another film. And I was stumbling over the line. I was saying, oh, there's absolutely positively the AK. I couldn't remember what it was. And Javier, Patreon supporter Javier, says the Samuel L. Jackson quote I was looking for was from Jackie Brown, AK-47. The very best there is when you absolutely positively got to kill every MF-er in the room, except no substitutes. And I love that line. I haven't seen Jackie Brown in a long time, but it made me think about this other time Sam Jackson made a similar quote, but this is very Star Warsy. So check this out. Here's Sam Jackson.
Bladed lightsaber. When you absolutely, positively got to kill every droid in the room, except no substitutes.
Did you make that out, Jamie?
Oh, beautiful.
I wish I could remember where I got that soundbite from. I've had it in my arsenal probably since the special edition era. It may have been a special on Fox that aired around that time.
Oh, nice.
And I just always loved,
the double-bladed lightsaber. When you absolutely, positively got to kill every droid in the room, except no substitutes.
Yes, indeedy. So there, I just want to put some closure to that because, you know, I can't just let it go. So I'm happy you're here with me, Jamie, because the timing is just great on it. Last time we spoke, it was that conversation that made me say, hey, you know, I got to give Star Wars Rebels another chance, and I have to binge that thing before the Ahsoka show happens.
Did you manage to get through the whole thing?
I did.
Wow.
I did. And it took me, you know, I didn't finish it in time for the Ahsoka series, but okay. I actually just finished it like a few days ago.
Nice. No wonder you had all the Bendu quotes rattling around when you were doing the after shows.
Oh, it was a very positive refresher for me because the Ahsoka show has made me like Rebels more, and the rewatch has made me like it more, just simply because of the fact that it's some really great storytelling going on there, along with awesome animation that I don't think I really gave it its fair shake because I was just bummed Clone Wars got canceled.
Yeah.
And I think I took that out on Rebels a little bit. Plus there was just a lot of other things happening, swirling around in the Star Wars universe at the time Rebels was airing. And so I think it was just hard for me to really stay focused on that for, you know, a couple of reasons. I know that at some point midway through its original run, I was thinking to myself, oh my God, totally the heir apparent to Clone Wars. It's picking up on some loose threads like the Ahsoka thing, but Ahsoka's impact on Rebels is not as big as I think people want you to think it was, because she really only pops in.
Yeah, she's a guest star.
Yeah, she's just totally a guest star. It's not like she becomes part of the Ghost crew.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm so surprised to know that she and Sabine, well, I'm really not surprised, because the last episode of Rebels, when they have that prologue, or I mean the epilogue,
mm-hmm.
I always flip-flop those. The epilogue was Sabine and Ahsoka going off to find Ezra. So we knew they hooked up somehow. But the whole idea of her being trained in the Force, and she's a Padawan and partially responsible for the death of her family on Mandalore, probably during that Night of a Thousand Tears or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I mean, so I really appreciate you lighting the fire under me to get me to rewatch that show and see it through different eyes and focus on it. And it was great prep work for the Ahsoka series, let me tell you. I'm so glad I did it.
Yeah, in later series, in seasons, the animation of the ships, the animation of the stormtroopers, all of that was excellent. It was as good as what you'd see in the Clone Wars.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I have to agree. So some of that was getting by me, I guess, at the time. I mean, there's just so much Star Wars stuff going on. The sequel trilogy was coming out. There were conventions and spinoff films. And it's just like, yikes, a lot to deal with. So it was worth the rewatch. I just scored a Rebels action figure today that I didn't know was missing from my collection until I went looking for it in the wake of Grand Admiral Thrawn's appearance just this past week on Ahsoka. But I finally got the Rebels version of Thrawn.
Nice.
So there he is. And I was surprised to know that I didn't have him. But he is a cool figure.
Does he come with Kung Fu grip?
No, he comes with actually very little articulation at all. I mean, his legs barely even move, for crying out loud. I'm afraid to force it because it might snap.
You know,
I might snap after what I paid for this thing on eBay. And it came carded, too, and I took it off the card. I don't care.
I had a large collection of Star Wars toys when I was young. Mm-hmm. And I think that they were probably all gone by the time I was maybe 10 or so, right?
Yeah.
And the first time that I came into contact with one in, decades, was just a little while ago. We went to Pittsburgh for the Days of the Dead. They did the horror convention there. Oh, and yeah. They had a place where people were, you know, they had traded in their old action figures. They were obviously very used, but they were, you know, selling them for $30 or so. And it was amazing, the just, you know, wave of memory that came over me from, you know, seeing these figures again in real space. It was seeing how small they were when my memory of them was so much larger, because my hands were tiny back then, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Just thinking of the memories of playing Hoth in the snowbanks outside our house and leaving some of the action figures out there, and in the spring I'd see them you know, kind of in the yard. It was an interesting thing, and I kind of got a sense of why you'd want to collect them all your life.
It's it was like when I stopped collecting them, I don't know. I was going into high school and I just thought, well, it's toys. It's for kids. And Star Wars is wrapping up. So is my childhood. Time to go to high school and start facing adulthood head on at age 13 or however you 14, however you are when you go into high school.
Yeah.
And it was just only, so that would be summer before my freshman year. By you know, the first half of junior year, I was actively purchasing those things again because they were all going on clearance. And so I looked at it as a good opportunity to fill holes in the collection.
Smart.
But that was brief. That was short-lived. And obviously, I didn't take any action figures with me when I went to college for a few years. I left all that stuff at home, but I wasn't actively collecting or anything like that. But then it all came rushing back at me in the 90s when things like toy fairs and pop culture conventions, things like that started popping up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be like, now I could maybe fill some blanks in the collection here. And then from that point forward, it's just been a loss. I've been a lost cause. It's, you know, the amount of money. Sometimes I think about that, you know. I regret the amount of money I've dropped on that stuff.
I hear you, but there are worse ways to waste money. That time, I spent I think that it must have been a significant fraction of my paycheck on DVDs, and now of course the format is is obsolete, and half of the DVDs that I bought within 20 years, they weren't working anymore. At least they'd work, but they'd be skipping it at some point. And I had to replace them all with, you know, purchase copies from Apple, or, you know, get a streaming service.
I've had various levels of collecting problems on my income. Problems with my income, maybe I should. You know, there are things that have passed along through the years. Vinyl, and then CDs. Vinyl and cassettes, and then CDs. Yeah. Spent a lot of money on that. And then the underground stuff. Bootlegs, which you always paid a premium for.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I remember once I bought like a 4-album thing, and it was like $80, and I couldn't believe it, but I bought it anyway, just because I had to hear it, you know. And now it's all that stuff that I hunted down and would take 2 buses and 3 trains to get to purchase, to blow $70 or $80 on, and then take it all the way home and listen to it. It's like, now you could just punch it up on YouTube and listen to it for free. And you don't even have to leave your bathroom.
It changes the experience, doesn't it?
The thrill of the hunt. There is something to be said for that. And so it becomes more than just a passive experience of hearing something. It's, right. It's you know, you're physically going out, you're hunting it down, you're paying for it, you know, that's, you have a goal, and then you get back and you spend time with the music.
You have ownership of it. You feel ownership of it.
There's a stronger sense of that too. Yeah. And thus leading to a greater connection to the music and the musicians, or greater rejection of the music and the musicians.
Right.
What'd I pay for that for? That sucks. These guys suck. You know why? Because they hit you in the wallet. That's why. And a lot of times, once you cracked open the vinyl or the disc, they wouldn't take it back. They wouldn't take it back because they thought you made a copy of it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then the librarians. I'd be checking out, like, you know, Chicago 7. And they'd be like, oh, you know, you better not make a unauthorized copy of that copyrighted material. I'm like, oh, I don't have any of that stuff. I don't do that.
I guess
I pick up the blanks on the way home.
Pirate Jimmy. I love it.
Man, now you were saying?
Oh, no, I was going to say that, you know, if you're growing up with all of the music that's, you know, that's available streaming, then your relationship to the music really changes, I think. And like, I don't think that my son ever had a clear idea of like decades of music. Like each decade has its own musical identity, and it was all kind of there, omnipresent, you know, because you can just get it off of the Amazon Alexa, whatever you ask for is right there. So he'd be listening to jazz, and then he'd, you know, be listening to, you know, What Does the Fox Say, you know, right to next to each other without any idea of like how, you know, these are contrasting.
Yeah. 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 It just gets fed to people differently. And it's without boundaries, though. That's one great thing. I mean, I was always restricted by the boundaries of rock radio. So I missed a whole bunch of things, you know. To have the streaming and have the automatic shuffle or whatever, I mean, that opens up a lot of doors, I think. So, there's different relationships, I think, that people will develop with music. And how old is Caleb?
12.
He's 12. So he's getting right into that time when a lot of kids start to develop their own personality with music, their own relationship with music, their own personal relationship with music.
Yeah.
And yeah, it happens at around 12. Between 12 and 14, you really start to see that begin to develop if the person is really into music. I mean, a lot of people treat it very passively. They just, you know, whatever's popular they like. But, you know, when you really start to search out specific types of music and you start developing your musical identity, that's when you're usually about 12 years old at about that time, I think.
The Beatles is has been his touchstone for a few years now.
Ooh, the Beatles, that was big for me when I was 12, because that's when John Lennon got shot, when I was 12.
No kidding.
And so, like, nobody really was talking about the Beatles like they do now,
right?
In the 70s. It was like, you know, they were a band, a huge band, largely influential band that broke up, and their individual members had solo careers that were of various quality. But John Lennon had fallen off the map around 1975 and didn't do jack squat until Double Fantasy, which was released right when he was shot. As a matter of fact, the guy who shot Lennon had him sign the actual album sleeve earlier that day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so, but I mean, the Beatles just weren't like part of the conversation for kids my age. You know, we were more plugged into whatever was coming out then.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden the Beatles were everywhere again. And that was because, you know, as a result of John Lennon dying, there were tributes everywhere. So I saw this movie that was directed by Richard Marquand, who directed Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
It's called Birth of the Beatles.
Oh.
And I think you can watch it on YouTube. And it's just about their rise from Liverpool through Germany to finally getting the call to go to America. And then it ends. It's just about the early years, about the Pete Best, the Stu Sutcliffe, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it's not like it's a great movie or anything, but it was a really fast education for me about who these guys were and where they came from, you know, their whole origin story. And so then I just started listening to the albums, oddly enough, in their release order. I had picked up a magazine or something that had a discography in it. And so I was just ticking off the boxes, and I would buy it in vinyl or cassette or even 8-track. So I was listening to the Beatles as they were being released. By the time I got to the White Album, I don't know, I was like 13 or something. I don't think my mind was really ready for all of that stuff yet. Right. I was a few years away still. But I was like, what happened? They were the lovable mop tops. What is all this? Helter Skelter. Oh, my God. But obviously, I grew to love all that stuff. And it all started when I was 12. And it all started. It was the dominoes all began falling after that sick SOB shot John Lennon in New York. It was just, you know, it had that impact on me. And then right within a month, or it was like the next month, John Bonham from Led Zeppelin died. And, that was the same year.
It was the first year that MTV was around, right?
No, that was like...
Was that a year after?
It was like next, I think MTV came on around 81.
Okay.
Bonham died in 80. Lennon was shot in 80, right? I'm pretty sure I remember all that correctly. But it was just a 1-2 punch. And so yeah. I got introduced to Led Zeppelin. So, I mean, it's just unfortunate ways the kids of my generation were being introduced to a lot of great music from the 60s and 70s was as a result of tragedy, you know?
Right.
And so that's how it happens, unfortunately, sometimes. But the Beatles, that's a great place for him to start.
Yeah,
that's really.
So I was thinking about music in Star Wars today, actually.
Okay.
So you got to figure that the Cantina song, the original Cantina song, right? It's based on music that was from 40 years previous. And I was, although, you know, it sounded like it was kind of timeless when I first was introduced to it. And I was thinking, you know, what music is from 40 years ago would you be able to put into a Star Wars, movie and have that kind of effect? And of course, in Return of the Jedi, they actually had, you know, were riffing off of music from the 80s, but it didn't have that kind of impact. I don't know if you feel differently about Max Rebo Band and, you know, the stuff that they did in the two different versions, but I don't think that I could think of anything that that would have that kind of alien and also universal quality as they had with the little jazz nuggets that you have there.
I was just thinking about Back to the Future today.
Uh-huh.
And when Michael J. Fox, he visits Marty McFly while he's sleeping. And yep. he's wearing the hazmat suit and stuff. He has his Walkman. He puts it on Marty McFly's head. He hits a button. It's this riffing solo, right?
Van Halen,
what's that?
Is it Van Halen?
It is Van Halen. It's an uncredited Eddie Van Halen appearance in Back to the Future. Mm-hmm. And so he's just flying. And so he says, it wakes up Marty. He goes, I am Darth Vader. So that's like, that's Darth Vader's audio assault when he shows up. It's Eddie Van Halen guitar solos. So I wish they incorporated that into the original Star Wars trilogy somehow. But
that would be great.
Back to the Future was after that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they should try to find a way to maybe somewhere in the 5150 vaults in L.A., they'll dig up an Eddie Van Halen guitar solo that could be a Darth Vader theme in a future film or streaming series or something.
Yeah.
To make sure the circle is complete.
It seems like Kevin Kiner really wants to bring a lot of different sounds to Star Wars. And I remember like listening to the different roundtables that you kind of felt at the beginning of the Clone Wars that it wasn't really Star Wars. At this point, when we're listening to Ahsoka, I don't know about you, I'm hearing the same type of music, but he's got it so subtle that it kind of blends in without me bumping on it at all.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Kevin, I think, was given orders from George Lucas to be as experimental as possible and stay away from the John Williams sound when it came to Clone Wars early on. And then I think wiser heads prevailed and, you know, I mean, there's a certain sound to Star Wars, which, I mean, outside of the amazing reinvention of it all by Ludwig Göransson, who just, but I mean, he still included orchestral things a la John Williams in his soundtracks as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, he plugged in a lot of different things, especially a lot of electronica stuff. But I mean, even things like didgeridoos and weird vintage music equipment that you can't find anywhere else. He was plugging in even the old recorder you used to play in school. You know, you play Mary Had a Little Lamb on that with everyone. He's using that kind of stuff. So it's like the most rudimentary musical instruments to some of the most incredibly, electronic things that, you know, is it even music? You know, you ask yourself saying sometimes, or is this music or sound design? But both can be effective. And with Kiner, though, he developed over the years. So with Clone Wars, I think he developed a great style, and he invented some killer themes for some of the characters, especially Ahsoka, which we hear every week now on the Ahsoka show. But then with Rebels, he was so much more plugged into John Williams for Rebels and recycling John Williams' themes, reimagining some of his themes at times. But it was very John Williams sounding. Now with the Ahsoka show, I think it's still very John Williams sounding. But you're right. I mean, there's other elements to it that Williams would, you know, not typically include in his music, like an electric guitar or some drums or something. And I know there's some electric guitar in Attack of the Clones during that speeder chase, but that's really the only example I can think of hearing electric guitar in John Williams soundtrack music for Star Wars. But so Kiner is, I think, still plugged in more to the John Williams type of Star Wars sound than anything else. He is a big Led Zeppelin fan. I do know that. And I talked to him about Zeppelin once. I asked him about some bootlegs and stuff. He didn't seem too plugged into that. You know, he wasn't wasting his part-time, the money he made as a part-timer in high school, you know, going to weird record stores in the city to blow the entire paycheck. You know what I blew my paycheck on once? It wasn't a paycheck. It was a Christmas bonus. I was working right across the street from a Borders Books, and I would go in there sometimes to look at what new Star Wars books they had there and stuff. And I noticed they had the box set of the Star Wars radio dramas for Star Wars and Empire in a box set of CDs. So this is like the 90s, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I got a cash Christmas bonus. And I walked right across the street and bought that thing.
Oh.
Just boom, right like that. I don't even think I put the money in my pocket. I just walked right across the street, bought it, because I've been dying to hear that thing.
You spent your money wisely.
Well, I think so. That gave me hours of entertainment, that
yeah.
radio dramas. And when they were originally on, I recorded them. And they were very rude-sounding recordings. But I think I have some of those somewhere in my house, like up in my attic or someplace.
And sure. And
those things survived.
You can get them on Audible as well.
Oh, yeah.
That's all I'm listening to them now.
They're back. They're on Audible because they were mm-hmm. off Audible for a
while. Oh, no.
But that's good to know that they're back on.
Oh, I ordered it 10 years ago, so.
Oh, I see. Well, I see what I mean?
Old information.
Well, let's see. I'm going to punch it up now because I need to replace those and re-listen to them.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I was thinking about that today as I was thinking about Ahsoka and the pace at which it's moving, mm-hmm. because one of the first audio drama that they did of the original Star Wars movie, that one is the best of the three. And I think that the reason is that it takes its time and lengthens out all the places where you kind of want to hang out with the characters, like mm-hmm. on the Millennium Falcon on the way over to the Death Star.
Yes.
They give you that extra space. And that's what I was hoping for with Star Wars television, that mm-hmm. when you got to have a movie, you have to keep everything going, you know, at a breakneck pace, and you create those places where you want to spend more time mm-hmm. and the audience is left without, you know, that satisfaction. But with television, you can do that. The whole point is you have as much time as you need. But with the Ahsoka series, and I'm enjoying this Ahsoka series, but I'm not seeing them take that time to kind of sit and kind of luxuriate in the characters being around each other and interacting with each other the way that, you know, I got with that original Star Wars audio drama.
Yeah, okay. You know, at best, you get moments like that between Ahsoka and Hu Yang.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to think of any other, and you get moments, they're mom and son moments, but with Hera and Jason,
mm-hmm.
which I think are all right. But yeah, I do get what you're saying. I get what you're saying. You know, you want to just be with them in the cockpit of the ship for a few scenes and
yeah.
and watch their chemistry build and their repartee and all of mm-hmm. that stuff, and turn 3PO off a couple of times just for laughs, you know,
exactly,
after he's told you what the odds are one too many times, things like this. See, I'm talking about it from a place of, like, you know, it's like going home. So
exactly,
and that is a good thing, and something that you want to see come from Star Wars is that those relationships, and not just, you know, it's this way between these two people just because. Maybe you'll find out in season two. See, that kind of stuff, just, I find it hard to be on board with the characters. You got to be on board with them, which means you got to know what's going on in their heads, and you also have to know a few other things that the characters themselves don't know. So right. that way you're invested in both the characters and the situations at hand. So that's what I look for in storytelling.
Do you feel like the scripts might have been rushed and maybe didn't go through as many iterations as they needed to?
No, I mean, this is a story that's been bubbling under the surface for 5 years now. I mean,
well, I'm thinking, I mean, everything that you've been talking about with Ahsoka for the last, you know, on this, it all seems like we're talking about is an early draft of a script where you have to get some feedback, and you have to go back in and punch it up. The conversation that you had last week was fantastic in with regard to that, in terms of, you know, the notes that you might have that they might have gotten from a somebody coming in from outside to be able to say, okay, this is what's going to give you a fantastic top-notch season.
Yeah, well, they know how to reach me. So Filoni knows how to get a hold of me, that's for sure. But, you know, I mean, Filoni wants this to be the way he wants it. And the whole first draft thing, I was under that impression for The Last Jedi that you were working off a first draft the whole way through. I also get the feeling that they were working off of like half a draft for Rise of Skywalker.
Right.
And that thing really went through a bunch of different iterations in the editing process once the cameras were turned off. So I don't know if that's just how they do things, or if there's too many cooks in the kitchen and maybe things got edited out of the show. Maybe it's heavy-handed editing happening.
Or not enough cooks in the kitchen. Maybe having a writer's room, that's better staffed would be working better.
Well, that's all quite subjective.
Yeah.
And it's hard to say better writer's room or a rush draft or anything when we still have two episodes of the season floating out there. So it might all come around to some payoff, but I've really enjoyed Ahsoka, and I find myself this week, especially, like, really looking forward to it.
Yeah.
I think the fifth episode with the reunion between Anakin and Ahsoka, I thought that was just like some outstanding Star Wars, some of the best that streaming has to offer. Mm-hmm. But I've just noticed that the rest of the season isn't so much about Ahsoka as it is a fifth season of Star Wars Rebels. And I would have preferred it to be more focused on Ahsoka. She's kind of just walking through the story, and she had her one episode out of six thus far has had a heavy focus on Ahsoka.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, that was your favorite.
Oh yeah. That was one of my favorite Star Wars streaming episodes of all time. I rank it up there with the season two finale of Mandalorian, One Way Out of Andor. And, yeah, you know, there's a bunch of others too. Keep in mind, I liked Book of Boba Fett.
I did too.
A lot of people didn't, but I got just about everything I needed out of Book of Boba Fett.
I think it knew what it wanted to be, except for the mod squad.
The mod squad sucked, but I liked the mod thing that they had. You know, but was it really necessary to have a whole gang of bionic teenagers or whatever they were? I mean, just
right.
The mod thing was there to explain how Fennec Shan survived.
Right.
That was all we needed. We didn't need this backup squad, but they just realized that Boba Fett was there by himself.
There,
I don't know. He
needed troops. Yeah.
Yeah. But they had the villagers from Cobb Vanth's village. They had all of those people as backup.
Okay.
Just focus on them, you know. Just focus on those guys. The mod squad was really out of place for Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And every action sequence any one of them was involved in turned into just an unfortunate mess. So I think that colored a lot of people's opinion of the series on a whole. But maybe I'm unlike a lot of people. I like the story of Boba with the Tuskens. I dug that. I love that train episode when they took down that train and the pikes and everything. It's just,
yeah. Hey, everything with the Rancor was a lot of fun. It was
Cad Bane.
Yeah.
That was good. The Cobb Vanth stuff was good. They drove the Slave One into the mouth of the Sarlacc pit. I mean, just saying that is like, yes, it's something I would have done with my action figures.
Yeah.
But at the, you know, sometimes Star Wars is just creative people playing with action figures. Let's face it. That's what it is. It shouldn't be that all the time.
Right.
But because there needs to be a focus on character development and mythology. And Filoni has a very heavy development of mythology going on right
now. Yes.
It's just he needs to give us more upfront reasons why the characters are, what's fueling these characters. And that's being, he's being very coy about that, about just letting the characters reveal themselves. Like, what's Balin's goal? I can't go through this list every week, but I keep going through this list every week. What made Ahsoka train Sabine? Why did Ahsoka walk away from Sabine? You know, where's Luke? I mean, you let us know Luke is out there. I mean, what's he doing? These are important things, I think, for the health of Star Wars to have, you know, it's you know what together. So
sure.
So okay. So music though, I threw out a couple of things. You know, Ludwig. We broke down Kevin right. Kiner. What other music has been getting presented to us in Star Wars? There was the soundtrack for the Kenobi show, which I felt like it fell a little flat. I could have used more John Williams cues in there.
Okay.
But I do like the theme Williams created for Kenobi.
Yes. It just didn't stand out. It wasn't as developed.
No. No.
Right.
And the music from Andor is like nothing stands out in that to me at all. Because it's inconsistent. It goes from orchestral stuff to synthesized stuff to, you know, drum machines and things like that. And
yeah, so you're right. It is probably the most Star Wars that isn't relying on the music to propel it, isn't it? That wonderful space battle where he's got his little he's trying to get away from the cruiser. Did that even have music that was underneath it?
Oh, the Luthen sequence.
Luthen, yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't recall.
Yeah, I'm almost thinking that they went without it to kind of heighten it.
Well, you know, Andor is like a bare bones kind of presentation. Where
yeah.
It's the Star Wars-y stuff isn't really taking center stage. It's more these human relationships going on with people like who are finding themselves in a bad situation that just keeps getting worse. So yeah, it's a totally different take on Star Wars. I got room for all the different takes on Star Wars.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I'm good with
it. And that expanded it, like the palette of what Star Wars is, I think, in a great way.
Well, it made us look at the Empire in a way that reinforces all the reasons why we should fear it, from every threat it provides to freedom.
Yeah.
I think Andor does a really great job at letting us know, hey, they're not all just goofy stormtroopers who can't shoot the side of a barn.
Right.
These guys are, this is a very scary, regime that has unlimited resources, and it's hard to even fight it from within because there's so much infighting going on already.
Right.
Between ambitious senators, ambitious officers, it's cutthroat.
It was a couple of weeks ago, but there was an interesting point that I think Jason made about the inner worlds and the, you know, if you are from the core worlds and you're well off, you may not have even noticed the change in regimes, you know, from the Republic to the Empire, you know, to the New Republic and so forth. Do you think that everything that we're seeing is basically the equivalent of like the developing world in the Star Wars galaxy?
Can you rephrase that question? I'm really not sure.
Sure. It's, so he's
the developing world.
You've got you know, the rich countries, the first world, right? And in Lucas's idea, the core of the galaxy is basically this rich part of the galaxy, right? And then you go into the midrim, and you might have, you know, some problems with resources and that. And then you get to the outer rim, and it's like you might wind up in some really nasty places. You might also, you know, have a decent place like Naboo, but Naboo is always under threat from, you know, its neighbors, you know, something along those lines. So it seems like he's mostly, most of these stories that we've seen, if they're not on Coruscant, they're usually in the midrim or in the outer rim. Mm-hmm. And until we, you know, we got a little glimpse of what it might be for the core worlds with the Mandalorian season 3, when we hear these people talking about, I don't even know what's going on with this whole political thing, and everything that we've kind of known, the struggles and so forth, is kind of, it might just be playing on somebody's you know, hollow television, as background noise.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, just like in our own real world, you get desensitized, and I think the Clone War desensitized the entire universe, you know. Yeah. And so it was easy then for Palpatine to get away with what he did because he was doing everything in the name of law and order.
Right.
Ring any bells? So, you're expanding on what Jason said in a really interesting way. Also, remember in Ahsoka, they do visit the core worlds when they go to Corellia.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, quite an illustration about what's going on with corruption within the New Republic and the existence of many who are still loyal to the old empire. So, not everyone was down with the end of the empire because you know that a lot of people were able to profit off of it.
Right.
In some way. And so, you know, with the end of that, that might have removed any sense of profit for some of these individual business people and you know, weapons manufacturers and military suppliers and all of that. And so they'd be up to things behind the scenes to try to flip the coin again, bring back the empire. And that's where I think Thrawn is going to play on those people and their emotions. And so we might see even like civil uprising happen with the return of Thrawn, where it's not all about destroyers and blue skinned aliens and stormtroopers. It's about people rising up, trying to reclaim their space in history. And yeah, so that's kind of compelling when you think of it that way, for sure.
Yeah.
And to see how Hera is a military, you know, a war vet, somebody who's a career military person. She's, you know, they show how she kind of gets kicked around after all the sacrifices she made. It depends on people's perspective. So, I mean, to some, Hera, she saved the, you know, people like her. They saved the galaxy. To others, they rocked the boat.
Right.
Yeah, it's complex. It's not as black and white. Star Wars has always been a story that's been very black and white. And so these are interesting shades of gray they're introducing into the story. It doesn't feel as heavy-handed as the attempts to do so in The Last Jedi.
Well, that was a different conception altogether, right? Of what the Force is.
Well, how do you mean?
Well, remember the little montage as she's meditating. The first lesson that Luke gives her, right, is mm-hmm. it's almost like a Hindu conception of what the Force is, that you have the light side, which is growing, and then the dark side, which is decaying. But both of those are part of a natural cycle. Whereas the type of conception of the Force that we have in the original trilogy is that balance exists in the light side, and it's right. when you've gotten off of that, you basically mm-hmm. like fallen off the wagon or something, and you're now in a place where you might have more power, but you have less control.
Okay, well, I don't think that's redefining the Force. I think that's Luke's perception and approach at that point in his life, you know? He had mm-hmm. given up. And he had given up on the Jedi way. Now, the Jedi way is balance of the Force. That's a yep. Jedi thing.
I see where you're going.
Yeah, but like okay. none of this stuff.
So that's how the Jedi would see it, right?
That's only how the Jedi see it.
Yeah, and then Luke is getting away from the way that the Jedi see it. So is that the way that the Bendu would see it then? That you have the light side growing and the dark side decaying, but neither one of these are to be seen as unnatural?
Not so much, because Luke abandoned the Force. He cut himself off from it because he was representing the Jedi way. Okay. And he was trying to rebuild the Jedi until he got to this place where he's like, wait a second, what am I doing? This is futile. The Jedi are flawed. The Jedi have been always presented to us as flawed from prequel era. You know, when we get introduced to the Jedi, they're kind of a hot mess, you know.
It was a rude awakening, yeah.
Well, it is, because their arrogance made them think that they could control the Force. The whole idea of balance of the Force means control the Force. Not other people saw the Force the same way the Jedi did. Mm-hmm. The Jedi were just and right and all of that stuff, and they were steeped in the light side of the Force, which is, you know, on its surface, it appears to be a very good thing, but it's also sticking your head in the sand, too. Mm-hmm. And so the Jedi, they didn't dig on the dark side of the Force and thought that even tapping into it is unnatural for people to do. So, you know, you live in a galaxy where people are modding themselves up with bionic parts and stuff, but yet tapping into the dark side of the Force is considered unnatural. Okay. That's how the Jedi saw it. Right. And that's really what led to their downfall, because like I said, they were sticking their heads in the sand and they were ignoring the dark side of the Force. Now the Sith, they saw the exact opposite. They saw using the dark side of the Force is the right thing to do. So that, of course, messed them up. Mm-hmm. And made them, you know, they were victims of tons of infighting, and just like evil breeds evil.
Right. And it's all about power.
Yeah, and so that's a messy situation. Luke gets to the point where he thinks it's his job to rebuild the Jedi and bring that all back, but he notices the cycle, similar to the cycle Baylan noticed.
Mm-hmm.
So Luke just decides, well, that's the end of it. That's it's going to end with me as the, you know, the last Jedi.
Yeah, right, the last one that's going to teach. Yeah, that knowledge. Yeah.
And he's going to cut himself off from the Force, and he's going to pass away living by himself with turtle nuns on this planet that nobody knows where it is. So that's what Luke was doing. So at that point, he had his own definition of how the Force works, and then he explains it to Rey in that moment. And so Rey soaks in that information, and what she does with it will determine the future of the Jedi. You know, will they exist or won't they exist? Will she bring back the Jedi? Kathleen Kennedy says this film that they're working on is going, like, the premise of it is Rey made a promise to Luke, and she has to see through that promise.
Mm.
In the sequel trilogy, I mean, I'm not really sure what the promise is that she made to Luke.
Oh, I assume that it's to a Force ghost, right?
It's what?
That after the sequel trilogy is all done, that she's having conversations with him as a Force ghost.
Right. So that's when she makes a promise to him?
I would say so, yeah. That it would be similar to the storytelling in Ahsoka, where we're coming into a point in the story where there's a large gap of, you know, of the story that's missing.
Yeah, which just doesn't work. It doesn't work for me.
It gets a little frustrating, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm once bitten, twice shy in the Star Wars department as far as that stuff goes. I'm once bitten, five times shy, or five times bitten, 10 times shy, let's just say.
Yeah, but, so hopefully, you know, this movie would start with the promise, right?
Kathy talks about it as if it's part of the story that we've already heard. So I don't know what, you know, she's been hitting the vineyards at Skywalker Ranch or something.
Yeah, I can see the delivery now.
Yeah, so I got to, I'm going to dive into that a little bit and try to figure out. I mean, both me and Swank already did the dive, and we couldn't mm-hmm. come up with anything. But I bet there's something I can try to. So this is like a code you have to crack.
So, right,
Jamie, yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, you go. I was going to say, Jamie, what else you got?
Oh, okay. Yeah, the what you brought up is very interesting. The different ways that people are looking at the Force, and we have discussed this in the past. So the way that that Baylan Skoll looks at the Force, do you think that he is in the same type of place that Luke is in the Last Jedi, where he's still connected to the Force. Mm-hmm. He mm-hmm. is at a point where we know that he's using it for power, because he's, you know, his lightsaber is showing it, and he's willing to kill people to get what he wants. But mm-hmm. I'm not sure what it would mean for somebody to basically be in tune with the light side and also tap into the dark side. I remember hearing about this with Mara Jade, in the novels, but I'm not sure, like, philosophically, mm-hmm. what that would mean. It seems more like a game dynamic than a story dynamic.
Yeah. I don't know. I just to me, the words of Yoda to Luke were gospel in Empire Strikes Back.
I remember hearing that the first time, yeah.
That's the foundation for everything.
Right.
all knowledge of the Force comes from Yoda and Ben in the original trilogy. And to deviate from that makes me nervous. And Yoda said, once you venture down the dark path forever, it will dominate your destiny. And now, I mean, Luke, it could be said, he opened up himself to the dark side. But he kept it in check. He looked at his bionic hand and realized, you know, before he was going to deliver the death blow and kill his father, he realized that he's becoming that because he's, you know, he's letting the dark side, he's letting his fear dictate his, he's not letting the Force dictate his actions. He's letting his fear dictate his actions.
So he's at a threshold at that point, and he walks it back from the threshold. And so it, that idea of it dominating him doesn't happen. And in the prequels, what we're seeing is Anakin just blowing past threshold after threshold, right?
Right. Without consideration. He gets real selfish too because of Padme and his lust for, you know, he wants status. He wants to be a Jedi master. He's getting high off his own supply. He's believing the chosen one stuff. He's snorting that up. And that's a big flaw for Anakin, a huge flaw. With Luke, the writing is totally on the wall for him. If you give in to your fear, anger, aggression, you will become your father. And that's, he gets a vision in the cave on Dagobah.
Right.
That, you know, shows him, you know, he lashes out with anger the second he sees Vader. And as a result, and this is before he even knows Darth is his father. This is sort of a message being sent to him. You will become Vader. You know, your face is behind that mask right now, and you're looking at it. So, you know, that was a lesson. And then he races off to see his, you know, save his friends, which to me always seemed to be a very valiant thing to do. I mean, like the right thing to do is go help out your friends if they're in distress.
Right. But it's just not strategic.
But it was a trap. But it was a trap. And you know, everyone knew it. Luke even knew that he was walking into a trap. But he had to do it. And so as a result, he loses his hand. First step in losing his humanity, next step in becoming Darth Vader. And he also learns about his bloodline too in that moment too. So he's got a lot of guilt, a lot of weight to carry. And then in the next film, Ben says, you know, Vader's more machine than man, twisted and evil. Now we know Luke has a bionic hand. Right. So when push comes to shove, Luke remembers that bionic hand saved his life because it either could have kept going or it could have stopped right there. And it stopped right there.
Just I love like, it. It's an, you know, inoculation almost, right?
Yeah. And so, I mean, that's just such a clean progression of the character arc for Luke Skywalker. And we are riding shotgun with him the whole way through. Now, granted, between the films, there was 3 years there from 1980 to 83. And I don't know. Most kids I remember, they thought that Darth Vader was lying to Luke. Most kids, you know, didn't want to consider that.
Right.
Darth Vader could be Luke's father. But then by the time it came around, you know, it was all right. The whole story was all just right there. And we all learned as Luke learned, we all, you know, we saw the writing on the wall when Luke saw it. It was just like, we were just right there in lockstep with the character.
Sure.
That's what's so brilliant about the character of Luke Skywalker in the original trilogy. Is that you as a viewer are right there with him the whole way through. I mean, he doesn't learn anything. We don't learn anything that Luke doesn't know before Luke does, right? There's no mystery, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, there's information that gets revealed to us. At the same time, it gets revealed to Luke.
Right. Yeah, he's our point of view character.
Yeah, that's why he is the audience, and the audience is Luke.
Yeah.
With Ahsoka, the characters know all of this information, and the audience is totally in the dark. So that's why it's a struggle, and you can't compare the hero's journey of Luke Skywalker to anything happening in the Ahsoka series. It's not that clean cut.
You're right. Yeah, that's a narrative technique that you really can't lean on too much. A little bit will give you some interest, right? But you have to you have to be able to pay it off before it becomes something that's frustrating the viewer or the reader.
Yes. That being said, I can't wait till Ahsoka this week, and I'm really looking forward to the season finale. And I'm going to miss it when it's over.
The production values are top notch.
It's great.
I mean, I love the entire cast. I think that the way that they've envisioned the world is amazing. What is he calling them? The Night Troopers?
The Night Troopers.
That is something that I didn't, it never occurred to me that they'd be, like the Death Troopers, or that they'd be zombie stormtroopers. So that was a good addition from your show.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, yet to be determined. We don't know what these guys are. We don't know what the hell Merrick was. So, but he could be setting the stage for an eventual reveal about what these stormtroopers are. And we'll be like, oh, my God, he's just like Merrick. But I don't know if it's going to quite work out that way. I could bring Eddie Van Halen back into this conversation.
Please.
There was somebody in the RFR Facebook group who started calling these troopers EVH troopers because they have the stripes on them, just like Eddie has the stripes on his guitars.
Nice.
You know, Eddie's famous Frankenstein and 5150 guitars with his famous red, black, and white striped paint scheme. So they're the EVH troopers. And there's even more. There's even more in Eddie Van Halen Star Wars news here. I'm going to pull up this story. I was saving it for Star Wars and pop culture, but I'm just, I can tell you appreciate these sort of mashups here. And I have to find the article. I thought I sent it to me today. It's about the engineer who worked with Van Halen on their first album. His name was Don Landy. Landy. And he just did an interview with what's the name of this website? Tape Op. So yeah, Van Halen engineer Don Landy. It's his first interview in decades. And here's your Star Wars tie-in. He's asked by the interviewer, who's talking to him? It's a guy who does all kind of work on like Van Halen history. Greg Renoff. Yeah, he's written a ton of books about Van Halen. And he asks Don Landy, the engineer for the first Van Halen album, he said, I recall you telling me that when you recorded the first Van Halen album, engineer Kent Nebergall specifically decorated Sunset 2's control room. All right, Sunset 2 is where they recorded the album. Mm-hmm. And so Landy says that this guy, Kent Nebergall, another engineer, he had a Star Wars X-Wing toy. He brought it in, hung it up, and said, "This belongs here. Believe me, because these are the two greatest things I've ever experienced, Van Halen and Star Wars."
I love it.
And it was there hanging from the ceiling right between the two monitors in Studio 2 for all the time they recorded Van Halen 1. And everyone loved it.
Good stuff.
So, the two greatest things I've ever experienced, Van Halen and Star Wars. Nice.
So if I understand correctly, when they made the Cantina music, they were altering the sound so that, what is it, the bass wasn't showing up off of their instruments. It was just the higher registers that that showed up, and that's what gave it its kind of alien flavor, so that you weren't just doing, what was it, Benny Goodman?
Yeah, it has that sound because of the clarinets and the oboe, but it also has steel drums, and yeah, there's a bass. There's a very present bass, mm-hmm. and the bass line is sort of otherworldly. Yeah, but I never heard anything like specifically about like how they may have rolled off certain, you know, areas within the musical spectrum, mm-hmm. in the waveforms and stuff, and they like, you know, chopped out the bass here or whatever. I mean, I could see them experimenting that way,
right,
to try to make it sound otherworldly. But also all the like music that you would hear that was supposed to be source music or incidental music, mm-hmm. in the background in sci-fi shows, it was always real like synthy or like a theremin, like, you know, like non-musical, yeah. Non-musical. And right. You said it yourself, the Cantina Band, that's like an homage to Benny Goodman in swing jazz of the day and stuff. Mm-hmm. But just with, you know, some oddities. I think that's a fretless bass in there. I don't know. Maybe it's an upright bass. Because those are fretless,
mm-hmm.
and it's definitely being, it's not picked. It's definitely being played with fingers. But yeah, it sounds fretless to me. I don't know. I'm sure there's an episode of Star Wars Oxygen where we talk about it ad nauseum. But right now, on the Cantina theme, I'm just sort of drawing,
sure,
just going off of what my ears are telling me about it, as opposed to being able to apply any sort of research to conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just thinking that if you were to take other genres of popular music, mm-hmm. that you know, you could play with them in a similar way, not necessarily just, you know, bringing out the you know, the lower registers, taking them out, but, you know, doing interesting things to the instruments or whatever that would make them be alien. The idea that that Williams was given was that the idea is that, you know, aliens had heard jazz and were, you know, giving their take on it, right?
I love that. Yeah, I love that.
So they, you know, to take that kind of idea and, you know, do permutations on, you know, cover alien covers on, you know, music from the 70s and 80s would be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Alien covers of music from the 70s and 80s. What band would you go with in that situation? If you could pick one band, who would it be? Hmm.
I think that it would be Zeppelin. I mean, that's,
get the letter.
That's what I go for. But
what about like ELO? I mean, doesn't it like,
yeah, yeah. You've already got kind of a,
yeah, right. You got your space tie-in, or
yeah. Now Guardians of the Galaxy did a real big riff with the whole like first 5 minutes of their the second movie that they did was, what is it? the Hello Sunshine. What's that called? Mr. Oh my God. How come I'm forgetting this?
From Guardians?
Yeah.
Oh gosh. You know, I have a big problem.
Mr. Blue Sky. Oh, there we go.
Oh, ELO, of course. Of course, yeah.
Yeah. The I was going to mention Guardians again. I don't know if you've seen the third movie or not, but
I have. I did. I saw it.
I loved the take on a trap where Star-Lord says, if you know it's a trap, it's not a trap. It's a showdown. So
yes. Good line. You know, those Marvel movies, they go through me like tamales, man. I mean, really, they really do. Hey, you want to hear something really controversial? And I've only told this to my sons and Jason Swank.
Okay.
And there's one other person I talked to at the studio I work with. She's a proper nerd. And I told her this too. I think she was kind of repulsed, but I saw The Flash, and I thought that movie was outstanding.
That's great.
I don't know why it's derided so much. I don't know what it did to deserve everyone ignoring it. But you know, I avoided going to see it in the theaters just because of the word of mouth and the bad Ezra Miller press. And I watched it wanting to hate Ezra Miller. Mm-hmm. And I thought he turned in an outstanding acting performance in this thing. And he's,
yeah. His performance wasn't what people were kind of, being critical of. It was, a lot of the, special effects.
So some of the CGI was maybe on occasion a little off. Like I don't want to throw out too many spoilers, but they pay tribute to the history of live action DC.
Right.
And in that case, they recreate some characters and stuff, and it looks cartoony and weird, but some of it does. But I mean, I think it's forgivable. And then there's a part where his tooth falls out of his mouth. I thought that was pretty rough looking CGI myself. Mm. But I thought it, all in all, that kind of stuff is forgivable because it's really like a well executed story and a well crafted film. So you know, maybe some of the budget went to the actors and the cameos and all of that. There's one cameo at the end of the movie, which I bet cost a few bucks. But I don't know. I felt like it was a really well done film. I thought there were great nods to Batman 89 and Man of Steel. I thought they did a really good job with Michael Keaton bringing his character back, and
he was fun.
And not making it cheesy and respecting the character and respecting Michael Keaton's role in bringing the character to film and everything. I just thought it was really well done. So I told this to somebody and then I noticed that like, I didn't see her for 3 days. And so I finally went over to her area and I was just like, hey, does this have anything to do with my Flash review or anything? She assured me not, but I don't think it's gotten a fair appraisal from fandom because I thought it was one of the better DC films ever.
part of the problem is, people have seen a lot of this now. And they've seen a lot of multiverse stuff. They've seen a lot of superhero stuff, and it's getting to the point where you really have to come up with something original.
Yes.
In order to, and it has to be executed well in order for it to be accepted. Otherwise, you may have people going to see it, but it's not going to make back hundreds of millions of dollars you have to put into just to make it.
Right.
Ant-Man 3 was the same way. I watched that, and it wasn't a horrible movie, but because it was just kind of, you know, a fun little romp, but not as fun as the previous two that they did. It wound up not making, I think it might have just broken even, but it was considered, you know, a big flop for Marvel.
Oh, yeah. Well, the bubble is obviously burst on these superhero franchise films, and yeah, they have to go back and woodshed this stuff and come up with a fresh approach, whatever that's going to be. I don't know. Typically, I would say put this stuff on ice for like a decade or something, then bring it back, you know.
Exactly.
Build up the audience's appetite. But you know that's not going to happen because they have so much. They put all the eggs in the superhero basket and the franchise baskets now.
Yeah.
But the Flash film... I mean, maybe it was such a flop because, like you said, it's a case of bad timing and fickle fandom. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was a damn good superhero movie. I thought Keaton was awesome.
Keaton was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I thought it just really paid some great tributes to his run as Batman and the character in general. And I just recommend people go with the flow and let themselves enjoy it. It does the multiverse thing, obviously, but it handles it with clarity, and it gives you these visual cues so you sort of get what's going on and where he's heading and what's happening. And it respected an aging Batman / Bruce Wayne. I thought Miller's solid acting channeled Adam Driver and Keanu Reeves. I mean, I wanted to hate him. I wanted to hate him in this movie, and he gave me no reason to. I thought he was great. I was impressed. And, yeah, there were a few wonky CG moments. There's no question about that. But all in all, it had the things that I look for. Solid story, great character interaction and chemistry, and character growth along the way. And. Mm-hmm. You know, you guys know I don't let storytelling F-ups get by me. I'm on top of that thing, but I felt like everything that happened in this film was earned by the characters, and I felt their struggles and I felt their victories, and I just thought it really worked well. And I wish I saw it in the theater, quite honestly. But
okay. So you saw it on streaming?
I saw it last two Saturdays ago. Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought it was a little long, like a lot of them are. It could have shaved off 15 or 20. Yeah. But I don't know. I enjoyed it. So.
So yeah, the multiverse, I like the idea, not really for a way to kind of escape from having consequences, but I love the idea of different iterations on a character. I mean, that's, you know, when you first were having drama, right? Everything had to spring from the same sources, like the Greek myths. And so everybody would do their take on a myth that everybody knew. And now here we are, 2,500 years later, kind of doing the same things. Everybody knows who Spider-Man is. Now you take, Spider-Man across the universe, the multiverse, and you are seeing all these different ways of conceiving the same type of hero. So that's good. I hope that we don't see it in Star Wars. I don't think that that kind of concept is compatible with with the Star Wars universe.
I don't think so either.
I do like,
and also it doesn't have that sort of revolving door surrounding the characters.
Well, that's the thing.
I mean, the last thing I want to see is Harrison Ford sharing screen time with Alden Ehrenreich both playing Han Solo. I just, my head will explode if that happens. I'll be like, what the? So, I don't see it having any room in Star Wars. Not whatsoever.
I'm sure it would be. Oh, go ahead, please.
No, finish your thought.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I'm sure that it would be generated by artificial intelligence if we ever saw that.
Well, if they can do a good job with it, I'm open-minded, I don't care how the sausage is made, just as long as it's been cooked as long as it needs to be, and it's filled with flavor and explodes in my mouth. Jamie, I'm going to have to wrap up here. Is there anything else you need to throw in this time around?
No, I think that I'm good.
You know, it was a very great Q&A with you, as always. And I'm glad I felt comfortable with you enough to share my Flash review. Maybe I'm not as demanding by things like DC and stuff like that, like as I am with Star Wars.
Would you be more critical if it were something that you felt more kinship with there?
Oh, yeah.
More ownership of?
Of course. Okay. I think I would be, yeah.
Because I'm thinking that, like, the level of storytelling of The Flash is around where Boba Fett was. And yet, you know, that was something that you were, you know, happy to go along with, you know, week by week. It's not like you can't say that, you know, here or there was something that they'd slip up on, but in terms of enjoyment, it's good stuff.
Yeah, it's weird with some things you can let yourself go, and others I don't know. Star Wars, every one of these iterations of the story via new film or streaming series or animated series, it always brings out a different approach from me per each one, it seems like.
And
that's kind of changed.
Roger Ebert, right? I mean, his philosophy when he was reviewing something was always, is it doing what it meant to do?
That's interesting. But how are you supposed to know what it means to do?
Well, usually by the genre that it's doing, right? So Andor, the level of quality that you demand of Andor in terms of its writing is very high. I mean, I would expect it to be at like a Breaking Bad level of writing quality, and execution, every episode. But if we have something where it's Boba Fett and we know that what we're basically going into is to knock around the playset and the action figures a little bit and have a little bit of fun, then, you know, it's not something that we necessarily have to, feel like we're being cheated if there's some elements of it that maybe aren't working.
Well, I mean, you know, I just try to stay open-minded primarily. And with Ahsoka, we'll know when it's all wrapped up. We'll discuss the level of fulfillment that the story gave us on a story level, on a fandom level, and specifically on an Ahsoka level. So I think those things will be worth talking about. Everything tonight has been worth talking about with you, Jamie Bruno. You are definitely one of my favorite RFR VIPs. What a great stable of VIPs we got going on. Every Monday I look forward to these conversations. And, Jamie, sir, you didn't let me down.
Well, thank you.
And thanks everyone for listening to RFR Q&A. We'll have another one coming at you. No, next week we'll be coming at you with RFR RPG. So yes, I would love to be able to sneak in a Q&A on the same weeks we do the RPG, but my time is tapped lately with Ahsoka and everything else, so we'll see how it goes as we get deeper into the fall. Maybe I'll be able to sneak some in here and there, because I've had some VIPs asking me. I'm just trying to find the time. Also working on some Bondcast things.
Yes.
There's always things
going on. Thank you for doing that. The License to Kill. That was a very happy couple hours listening to that.
Well, me and Laird are going to break down the music from that film, and then we'll be ready to move into the Pierce Brosnan era.
Which is better than I had remembered.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to revisiting all of that. And so we'll really stay on top of it and definitely get GoldenEye out this fall, because we sure enjoyed talking to Jonathan about License to Kill recently.
Beautiful.
So we want to keep that wave going and not take long, lengthy breaks between these things. To us, those breaks don't seem nearly as long as they must to you guys. So we'll try to stay on top of that a little more. For now, RFR Q&A, we'll be signing off, and I just want to thank all of our Patreon supporters. You guys are amazing, and I want to thank all of our VIPs, too. Great guys like Jamie Bruno, who is always here to bring some awesome conversation to the Q&As, and we'll be looking forward to more of that from more of our great RFR VIPs, and I'll bet Jamie is going to be hosting another Q&A in the future here as we start booking all the slots for winter. So always appreciated, and thanks again, everyone. So on behalf of Rebel Force Radio and the RFR Q&A, I am Jimmy Mack, and remember, Jamie,
may the Force be with you always.
Always.